Hello and welcome back to my podcast, Dunya Rising. I'm Dunya, DJ, musician and sound healer based in Glastonbury, Somerset. And this is episode 9, the final episode of the season. And when I started this podcast, I didn't actually know how many episodes I was going to do. But it's interesting that I've ended on the number 9, which represents completion and the end of a cycle. So I'm going to be taking a break for reflection, the breathing room whilst I study music therapy, and maybe we'll be coming back with some new exciting interviews in the future. But for now, it's time to wrap this up. And I couldn't think of anyone better to end this season with than my beautiful friend Shivani Mata. Born in London, now lives in Glastonbury. She is a priestess, yogini and witch with British, Scottish and Welsh heritage, and her dad was from Trinidad. In this episode, we talk about bhakti yoga, what it means, the power of kirtan as a music for the people, spirituality and connecting to spirit or God all around us and inside of ourselves. Shivani shares about her upcoming book, The Faces of the Feminine, about the different forms of the sacred feminine in various cultures around the world. She retells a famous story of Kali, Hindu goddess associated with time, death and destruction. And we end this episode discussing the Yoni Shakti retreats she facilitates alongside Uma. We talk about cyclical wisdom and the acknowledgement of the menstrual cycle as a seasonal wheel. And this episode features snippets of Shivani's music, which is so, so beautiful. And we end with a full play of her song, Guide Me Home. So just a side note to this episode, I previously talked on social media about coming to terms with failures as a creative. And this episode really challenged me with that, as the first time I recorded with Shivani, my podcast mic didn't pick up her voice. And the second time we recorded, my Zoom mic didn't pick up my voice very well, which has been so triggering. This episode and the content in Shivani's story is so worth putting out there. So although it's not a professional quality with the sound of my voice, it is very worth the listen. And here are some of my favourite quotes from the episode.
The bhakti path of yoga is the path of devotion. It's to come to that state of union through the heart and through the mood of love. It's about cultivating love relationship in our lives between us and everything that we come into interaction with, into relationship with. And so when we say Yoni Shakti, Shakti is like power. It's the feminine force of power. It's creative power. It's the creative energy. So Yoni Shakti is the creative energy that lives in the source of our being. There is a meeting between earth and water. It's like muddy and juicy. It's where things grow. In the yogic anatomy, it's like the crossover point between Muladhara chakra, the root chakra or the earth chakra, and Svadhisthana chakra, which is the like water chakra. Devotion is unique to every individual because it's your personal expression of love.
The first thing that jumps to my mind is you describe yourself as a priestess, yogini and a witch. What does that mean? And what are some of your offerings?
In some ways, all those words for me are a little interchangeable, and definitely with particularly the priestess and witch labels, for me, they're very much about being like elemental connection, living in this resonance that has an awareness of earth, water, fire, air, and space, and connecting with the land and connecting, like, I love to make kind of like herbal tinctures and things like this, just like kind of apothecary vibes, and do various kinds of rituals. I'm very steeped in a bhakti yoga lineage, so a practitioner of yoga is often called a yogi. And so the feminine form is yogini. I am that and have been that since I was a kid. My mum practiced yoga and did yoga with me from when I was a baby. So asana practice. And then as like in my teenage years, I got into the more devotional practices of yoga and kind of apprenticed as a pujari, like, which is like a priest, or pujarini is the feminine, within a bhakti lineage. So I also, like, a part of my regular practice is these kind of devotional ceremonies. So that's also layered into the meaning of priestess as well for me.
There's lots of layers to it. That's just
Glastonbury. Living in Glastonbury.
I live in Glastonbury. Priestess of Avalon.
Yes, I'm waiting to hear. And really interesting because it's like, you know, most people might say, oh, what do you do for a living? I work in an office, I work in a garage, I work in a school. No, you, Shivani, are a yogini priestess witch, which I love. I love that you talked about the elemental connection. I was hoping that you might describe that, which you did. You know, the connection to earth, water, fire, air, and space, or spirit. I think that's really beautiful. I love that you mentioned your connection to the land, and you also talked about bhakti yoga. And that your mum practiced yoga, so it's really beautiful to know that you're actually raised in that way. And I would love to hear more about yoga. What bhakti yoga is specifically? Because I know there are different types of yoga. Hmm. I know there are many misconceptions around yoga. I know there's a lot of appropriation of yoga in the West without a real understanding of what it means. And since it is so important to you, I would love to hear what it means to you.
So one way we can translate the word yoga is simply as the word union. And so it's this idea that we're bringing our mind and our bodies into the same place at the same time. So you're not like thinking about some cute person you saw on the train yesterday, or like, I don't know, your to-do list for tomorrow. You're like, yeah, food. You're like right here, present now in this moment. And not only your like mind and body in union with each other, but also like your soul, spirit, whatever your personal ideas about what that is or isn't are. And yeah, there's like a oneness between you and everything in creation, basically. And so all of the yoga practices are things that bring us into more harmony with that state of union. So that help us access what I might describe as that like melting point between you and creation, which is like it's an indescribable state, I think. So the bhakti path of yoga is the path of devotion. It's to come to that state of union through the heart and through the mood of love. So it's about cultivating love relationship in our lives between us and everything that we come into interaction with, into relationship with. But also layering in on that is the kind of spirituality aspect of like deepening our love relationship, our love connection with the like beloved that is the divine, that is the universal power of love, that is nature, that is God, or whatever you want to call it, whatever you feel comfortable calling that. And the bhakti tradition has loads and loads of different practices within it that kind of help cultivate that spirit of love. When we say we're doing our yoga practice, we're practicing for real life. If you're an asana practitioner, like on your mat, or as a bhakta, like in front of my altar, is cultivating a mood that then hopefully is going to like spill over into my everyday life. So with these practices of love, it's like cultivating, I don't know, some people might like the term like loving kindness relationship, that then when I meet people in the world, I'm hopefully going to be
more disposed to see them through eyes of love also. And not only like other people, but like how I interact with the land and with nature, like my beliefs around how we care for the earth and how we relate to the earth, that we need to be loving and compassionate towards the earth as well as our fellow humans and animals and everything else, you know. So yeah, it's really diving into this spirit of love, the Bhakti tradition. Some of the practices within that to help cultivate that mood of love include kind of very ritualistic kind of ceremonies, what we call puja in Sanskrit, and that has a very like specific form and is in many ways very elemental. We use fire and water, and all of the elements are really present within the rituals, and ringing bells and all kinds of stuff. And then one of my favorite kinds of ritual is with the fire, what we call havan or yagna, the slightly different kinds of fire ritual, where there's like, if possible, you have like the fire pit is actually built into the earth, and it's called a kund, and it's meant to represent the mouth of the mother. So you're feeding the great mother, the mother earth, in gratitude for all the abundance that she gives us. And I really like this loving relationship that is shared within the fire ceremony. And then one of the really simple practices is a practice called kirtan, which is song, and we sing together in this practice. And I've really dived with this over the years. Since I was about 18, I started getting particularly into like the bhakti practices and into kirtan, and it's a very powerful practice on so many levels. And I think one of the things that's really potent about it is it's not mindy, like it's not wordy. It has words, but we're not like having a chit chat about our feelings. We're singing and allowing the power of these like kind of healing sounds to move shit within us, you know. So this is one of my favorite practices and one of the things I guess I'm known for doing most in the world. And the way that this practice is shared, kind of the roots of this practice, is it's very much like the music of the people. It's not like a learned art, it's an expression of our hearts, an expression of our devotion. So back in the day in India, it would have been like, it wasn't like highbrow Sanskrit that it was sung in, it would like be combined with local village languages, and it quite like raw and wild, because it was just like, it's just the expression of the heart, and that like outpouring of love sounded. I personally am a child of cross-pollination. Like, I have roots in different parts of the world, so the way I relate to the world and understand the world is not from one place and one piece of land, although I am very connected to the English soil because I was born and bred here and my mother line is here. So the way I express in my devotion is a fusion of different things. So it includes a lot of inspiration and roots of my bhakti lineage, and then I also have I've been working with a shaman in Brazil for the past 15 years as well. And so like the shamanism of the mother goddess, that has also inspired how I relate to the world and my devotion. And then the music I was raised on, like dub and soca and reggae and all of that. And so like that is present in how what comes out of me and how I express, because that is a part of me. And I think that that's a really beautiful thing about what bhakti is. Devotion is unique to every individual because it's your personal expression of love. Did I answer your question?
That was the best answer ever imaginable in the entire world. That was so articulate and so many different threads that I want to talk about. I really appreciate you breaking down in a simple way that yoga is about union. I love that you described it as your mind and body in the same place at the same time, because I often find my mind is flying around the room in so many different places.
Mm.
And I really understand what you mean about actually when we are practicing yoga, it's coming back to breath, coming back to the body. And I often find my mind, even often during these practices, is still very busy. And
yeah.
We're living in a society where we are so distracted that it's almost like you feel a bit disconnected. And I reflect on myself, why is it that I keep distracting myself and keep avoiding coming into the present moment? I can't quite figure that out, but I know that there's definitely, for me and many others, it's almost like to stay busy feels more safe, to stay in an adrenalized space feels a lot safer
definitely
than coming into calm, which feels quite sad.
And I think that this is one of the like really powerful things about the practice of kirtan and using this music as our meditation is such a powerful thing, because it gives those like busy minds something to do. You know, it's not just like sit here and watch your breath, which
it's
like
really hard,
which is like for sure like a beautiful practice, but like it's not that easy if your mind is busy. But if you give your mind like a good beat and like some like lyrics to like hold onto, it's like a life raft that takes you with it. It's not, you're supported in going wherever you're going into that state that we can't describe, rather than the more stripped back approach, which is still amazing, but it doesn't always work for all kinds of people.
No, it can be really hard. I mean, I've definitely been in places of real peace and calm. It's like this fleeting, rare and precious moments where I do feel union with myself, but it's almost like sometimes for me it feels like maybe there's a lack of trust going on, that something's going to go wrong. I need to be in control all the time, otherwise something will go wrong and I'll lose it or something. So, and I wanted to give voice to that, because I know a lot of people feel this similar feeling, that it feels almost calmer to stay overproductive, and it feels almost unsafe to come into the present moment. And if you look at what's going on in the world today with so much destruction and war, is part of that our own relationship with the lack of that kind of coming into the present and the calm that is causing this real chaos that we're seeing in the world today?
And a desire to control what's happening also, which is understandable, because life can be hard and there's so much challenge, and we often think that the way to overcome that is to hold on and try and form it. But there are so many things that are out of our control, and that's another like really key theme of like bhakti, is this like mood of surrender that's really part and parcel of this kind of devotional energy. There's a sense of like, I don't have to control or keep up with everything because Mama Earth's got me, or like whoever we want, whoever our prayers are to, you know, like there's this sense that we are being held and supported in some way, and that's not always easy to trust in. But the more that we can give ourselves, I mean, for me personally, I a lot is about the earth. If you ever come to like sing with me, I sing a lot of songs about the earth and Ma and this kind of mother energy, and to remind us that we are held with all of the challenge that comes.
Yeah, that's really beautiful, because I love the sort of language that you've used, that you've said about it's like a communion, it's a love meeting. How do we form that love with life? And then through those practices, how does that spill out into our everyday encounter?
Yeah.
I can very much encounter life with a lot of stress and frustration and irritability. I just, you know, when you talked about it spilling out into life, I immediately imagined me in the car being like, all this anger coming through. I was like, oh, I imagine if I was more in a state of love. And also, I love that you talked about seeing through the eyes of love. It kind of made me reflect, you know, you talked about this sort of the connection to our beloved, to spirit, to God, whatever word that we want to use. And I found in my upbringing, raised by a Muslim father, and my mum actually practiced Christianity, the way those religions were kind of presented to me, it very much often felt like the old white man in the sky scenario. But often it felt like if I wasn't identified as a Christian or a Muslim, then I was in danger or a threat of going to hell or something. And also, like, the idea that I was born a sinner. These are the sort of stories that were going through my head as a young girl, or that if I did something wrong, that I was in trouble. Whereas the sort of spirituality that you're talking about feels a lot more loving. This feels a lot softer, that sort of deeper, sort of redemptive love. Something that I think a lot of us are yearning for. So many of us are really have been on this long journey of searching for love outside of ourselves.
Yes.
If I sort of look back at my life thinking of troubles with addiction, troubles with overeating, troubles with searching for a lover and feeling like I'm not complete unless I find this one person who's going to save me, that story that repeats itself often. Just not ever feeling satiated in that, even in times of having drugs, that maybe I get a little bit of a high for the evening and then I feel literally so depressed the next day. And then still being left with that empty feeling, something missing, why is there something not right?
Yeah, questing and outside of ourselves.
In the future, then I'll be happy. There's some sort of happy dunya in the future. I'm chasing her and I'll be happy when I get the job, when I get the money, when I get the lover. And this love that you're describing feels a lot deeper.
Yeah, and unconditional. Like, it's not based on something we've done or something we've achieved, which is very much like the conditioning of our society, right? And like the marketing gods of like, you need this and then you'll be great. Like, you need to do this and you need this and you need this face cream and this whatever it is, and you're like, nothing. You're never satiated because there's always something else. For a lot of people, there's a lot of trauma around having like some kind of connection with a spiritual practice because of what you're describing of like being introduced through religious practices that believe in this like the bearded white man in the sky image. I know, like it's in my, it's in all of our heads.
Like Father Christmas in the sky, I can't get out.
Or, I mean, it doesn't need to be that particular image, but that we're looking to something outside of ourselves. And my personal belief that divinity, that the goddesses, gods, whatever we want to call them, yes, are something we can call upon that are a part of nature and like might be up in the sky, but are also all around us. That they're also inside of us, that they're not separate. And I think that this is a really important nuance for me. There's a beautiful Kashmiri poet called Lala or Laleshwari. She was in the 14th century. She's like a generation before Hafiz kind of thing in Kashmir. And she was really radical for lots of reasons. And like, one was that she like mixed different traditions together in the wisdom that she shared. So she was sharing like Vedantic thought alongside Shaivism, alongside like Sufi wisdom. Wow. Really different.
You don't often see that, actually.
And then she was also really radical because she danced naked in the streets as she sang her songs.
Okay, we'll be leaving a description of this woman in the description.
Yeah, and I'm really inspired by her. My last album, which is so long ago, the Jasmine Garden album, that's really like a lot came out of my inspiration of her and her poetry. Well, she has a number of poems with a similar theme, but one is that she's like, and I'm paraphrasing, I'm not doing the exact quote, but she's like, oh, I went everywhere searching and looking and trying to find something outside of myself, trying to find God. And then eventually I came home to my house, and there in the basement was jars and jars of the good stuff. Nectar, I tell you. And no one was drinking. And this is a really big theme in a lot of her poems of like, oh, I went everywhere with longing in my eyes, and then here in my own house, I felt truth filling my sight. It's a recurrent theme of like, it's not outside of us. Come home to ourselves, and this is where we find peace, truth, God, all of it, you know?
So beautiful.
Yeah. I love an altar. My mum worked in the fashion industry. I'm really like raised to appreciate aesthetic beauty. And so how that manifests in my spiritual practice is I love to create altars. But one of the things I always include in an altar is a mirror to make sure I remember that it's not about the thing that's outside of me. I'm also looking within.
I still catch myself doing, I'll be happy when.
Oh, of course, and yeah.
You know, I've still got to search for something in the future. When I've got this qualification.
It's so conditioned.
You know, when my bank account is in a better state. You know, it's still, I have to bring myself back. And
yeah.
I think one of those things, you know, you talked a lot about the divine is actually within us. I wasn't really raised with that belief. Mm. So it's kind of like a learning for me now. But one thing I found difficult is because the God was presented as a man, as a masculine. I struggled to see myself in the divine. Mm. And then coming to Glastonbury, where it was just this, the tables were turned and suddenly it was about the goddess. And I was like, oh, wow, we honour the divine feminine. What's that? And I had to go on this journey with that. Then I was able to then start looking for God within. And I think that's a really big thing. Brings me on to want to talk about kirtan, because you talked about kirtan as music, as a meditation, helping this mood of surrender. And I remember having an experience where a beautiful woman actually, where she was singing kirtan, and it was about the yoga event, and she was singing something around Ombe Ma, honoring the divine mother, and I just burst into tears, and I almost couldn't stop crying. It all just came pouring out of me. It was such a deep experience, because it wasn't even like I truly understood the words. It was just her voice, and that I knew it was about the Divine Mother, that it activated something within me. But a lot of the time, sometimes it feels like my tears are a bit blocked, or my sadness is a bit blocked. I feel a bit crap, but I can't get it out. But it was through the kirtan that suddenly the floodgates opened, which was such a profound experience for me.
And it's a really like, I think, common experience for people, because it does shift something that we can't like tangibly understand what it's doing. And there are like so many ways that we can cognitively explain why that works, talking about like, oh, that, you know, we're singing these sound formulas that are like healing our bodies and unblocking things, and there's all of this sort of stuff that we could go into. But actually it's just an opportunity to surrender into allowing energy to move within us in some way. Mm. And sometimes that means a lot of tears. Sometimes people like are in a really sort of stillness space. Sometimes it brings us into our wildness. And I think it's just like love. It has all of the moods of love. It can be really soft and sweet, and it can be really wild and ecstatic. And all of that is welcome. It can make you laugh. It can make you cry. Sometimes it can bring up your anger and frustration. And sometimes it can be like really peaceful. It's like love.
I love that you described it as music for the people, and that there is this sort of freedom of expression in that, because sometimes with spirituality, there can be a bit of gatekeeping. It can also feel like if you're not exactly doing all the exact rules, that you're doing it wrong. And I've definitely been called out for some stuff because I, you know, there were certain prayers from the Quran that I felt I wanted to connect with, but I can't do that because I'm a woman. I can't say it in that way. And only this person can do it. And, you know, I have a lot of respect that there needs to be traditions, and there is a lot of beauty in holding the traditions. But sometimes it feels like it's not accessible for the mainstream. And surely it should be for everyone. That kirtan seems that it is for everyone, even if you're not the most musical person, or you're playing the shaker or drum out of B.
Yeah.
It is for everyone. And so I love that you've described it as a music for the people. And I think that's so important.
Particularly with some of the more complex spiritual practices, you know, that they are all practices of transformation. And, you know, like within the Bhakti tradition, but within like traditions all over the world, I understand the necessity of gatekeeping, because you're wielding a certain amount of power through engaging with these practices. And if you don't know what you're doing, it can maybe have a transformational effect that we're not ready for, or that we don't know how to be present with, or, you know, and it can actually be quite dangerous. So there are a lot of lineages that, of course, like, there's a protection for a certain amount of safety, which I really respect. And also, ain't no one can tell you your relationship with creation, how you pray, or how you commune with life. Yes, like, honour the tradition, learn the traditions, go about it in the appropriate way of that lineage, and also let your heart find its own way of doing things and its voice and way of relating to life, because that is the most potent way for you to experience the world, is, you know, that it isn't because some man in a dress, you know, like with the fancy hat, told you that this is the way that you pray and this is the way you connect. It's like, that's all really great, and it's great to like learn techniques and all of that stuff, but if that comes in the way between your own relationship and you're completely giving your power over to someone else and putting them on a pedestal, I don't think that that's worth it.
I think that's a really, really important, because I think a lot of people may find spiritual teachers, which I think we all actually need, and I have so much respect for the people that have dedicated their lives to these practices, and that there is that sense of, I am unworthy, please show me
that. Yeah.
I can feel that sort of energy in certain spiritual traditions. I'm not good enough, please show me the way. And then we move away from our relationship with ourselves, which feels really sad, like that we don't have the power to connect with God. You must show me, and only through you can I connect with God, or only in this specific temple, only with this specific tradition, if I do it this exact way.
And then there's also the issue and this thing of, like, once our power is given away, then those people that we've put on a pedestal have the possibility to abuse and treat us badly, and gurus have a bad name because there are charlatans that use that power to abuse vulnerable people. And you are vulnerable once you give your power away, and when you're looking for the beloved outside of yourself.
It's another trap. You think, oh, but because it's a spiritual thing, it's okay.
Yeah.
It's the same thing as me overeating, or me taking drugs, or me searching for a lover. It's that same, something that's outside of me is going to fix me. And when I think about, I had a really deep, profound experience of feeling pure redemptive love. But I love that word, redemptive love, because that's how it felt. Or the deep connection to nature moment, where it just felt like there was nothing I needed to do. Everything was perfect. I was loved. I didn't need to do anything to be loved. I was already whole and worthy. And there was no destination. It was only the now. And I felt so blissful and happy in the now. And the idea of anything other than the now felt ridiculous.
Yeah.
It is now. That was a very beautiful fleeting. the point is, it was a redemptive kind of love.
Yeah.
I was already whole. I didn't need to do anything. Yeah. And I think sometimes it is, we fall into those traps again of I am unworthy and this person will show me how.
Yeah.
This drug or this new clothes or new technology or whatever it is, and just really wanting to honour that the wisdom that you're bringing forth, that it does come from within as well. Of course, there are these beautiful traditions, but we cannot forget the relationship with self.
And I love how you describe this, like, this moment of maybe we could say that state of union, that state of being fully now. And I think that these glimmers of that are kind of like what it's about. There's kind of this idea within the Bhakti tradition also that like part of it is this like mood of longing. There's the longing for union, but actually there's the idea that the true bhakta doesn't actually want the union because there's so much ecstasy in the longing. And so, yeah, we want the glimmers, the like teasing of like, oh, there's a a few seconds of feeling what that union's like. And then, you know, you want it even more. And you like are in that devotion and that yearning for that space. But like the like full, like highest path is to not truly want it. I don't know. It's about being present with the journey and not the destination. It's like, yes, we're longing for that space, but it's not that state of being is the only worthy part. Actually, the journey towards it, every moment of that longing and that desire to merge in love is valid. In Portuguese, there's a beautiful word, saudade, which is like this mixture of the longing. And there's also kind of like a grief in it as well. And like the yearning and that, like, I think that is what describes it best, really.
Yeah. I really felt that actually as a young girl. I was in church and it wasn't a super accessible church for me. But I remember having that feeling of like, looking for the light. I just couldn't find it.
Yeah.
But I just remember this real innocence of my youth, of just really wanting to find God.
Yeah.
Perhaps I wasn't in the space where that was going to happen for me, but just really like longing, is it in this hymn? Is it the lights coming through? When am I going to feel this?
Aww.
It was just that real innocent longing for it. I think that's a really beautiful word. Saudade?
Saudade.
Saudade. Really beautiful. Love to talk to you about the book you're writing, Faces of the Feminine, which is an overview of the many forms of the sacred feminine across different cultures in the world. And you said, your journey began as a recognition that there were aspects of myself that did not fit into that mold of the traditional stereotype of feminine, and therefore, as is conventionally understood, woman. There were parts of myself I could not look at, but I could not accept, that I felt ashamed of, that I considered dirty or felt guilty about. Then you go on to say, I wanted to bring out of the shadows the more gnarly, wild, raw, fierce and transformative forms, that which is often considered the dark feminine and recurrently feared for being other. Wow. I thought that was a really powerful, and I think a lot of women can really resonate with that, actually.
It's very surreal having you quote me.
I keep going. First of all, can you just talk to us about the book, Faces of the Feminine? What was your inspiration? And I would love to hear a bit more about what you mean about the dark feminine and your journey into writing this.
Earlier in our conversation, you kind of seeded what I feel like the wisdom of what I'm exploring in the book is, was this, that like idea that you said before, like you didn't see yourself in what you were presented to as God. And I think that this is like, was a really big part of my journey into how I like came to explore this theme and this work, was I guess that like conditioning and societal pressure of like what was acceptable of like how we present as a woman, and then also what was celebrated of like feminine qualities, and really feeling like, well, I don't tick that box and I don't tick that box, and I've walked with this in my life, or this has happened to me, and that is, if that doesn't fit into these boxes, then what do I do with that? And feeling that shame and that guilt and that at times like disgust at myself. And so my sadhana, my spiritual practice to like meet this, was it started as like a drawing project. I was like researching how the sacred feminine was presented in different cultures around the world, doing a lot of research, and then drawing these, for want of a better word, goddesses. Not all traditions would call their sacred feminine forms goddess. So yeah, I was like doing all of this research and drawing these forms of the feminine to try and bring some acceptance to the parts of myself that I wasn't seeing in what I was told was acceptable. And for me, a lot of that was lying in these more darker faces of the feminine, the more wild and, you know, the ones that really engaged with passion with their sexuality, or have that wild rawness of the like fierce spirit and expressed their rage, and seeing how, okay, at one point in time, this was something that was celebrated, that was honored as being sacred. And therefore, why would it not be sacred when it arises in me? And so I began writing up my research, as well as doing the drawings. And then at some point, very woo-woo, I had a dream where the goddess came to me. And it was probably about like 3 or 4 years into this book, and was like, need to start talking to people. And I got given like really specific questions, and then I began to have these conversations with people about people's personal relationship with these forms of the sacred feminine. So it wasn't just my like nerdy research, although it is that, plus like story time sections and my drawings, then it's also conversations with people that have direct connection to specific forms of the sacred feminine in lots of different ways. So it might be somebody that has been born and raised in a lineage, and this form of the divine has always been a part of their life, and they're talking about their relationship in that way. It might be someone that, you know, was on that external quest and then found a lineage that they really liked and got initiated in it and has gone for a very like formal route. It might be someone who has just been like dreaming for years about this being, and then one day goes to someone's house and like sees a picture of this being that they've been dreaming of and is like, well, who's that? The goddess has appeared to them. People have visions and dreams and all that sort of stuff. So it's really perhaps in some ways controversial, because it's not purely lineage based understandings of these forms of the sacred feminine. It's some that is that, and it's some that is from that spontaneous arrival of them in our lives. And something about speaking to people added an extra layer of aliveness to this project, to this work for me, particularly like how we learn through the sharing of our story,
how we learn about ourselves and how we learn about each other and life. Kind of what we're doing now.
Yeah. How storytelling, I do love your podcast. I mean, it's just so cool. I don't even know how to articulate it. What a gift to offer the world to be writing this book that seems like it almost happened in a kind of spontaneous way.
Oh, very much.
I'm going to write a book. I'm really passionate and nerdy and I want to draw these goddesses and understand them. And I always find that really beautiful about creativity, that often it's not in this standard, I'm going to write a song, I'm going to write a book. It just channels through.
It was an evolution.
Yeah, it's powerful. And, you know, I love that you talked about the kind of unpicking the conditioning of what was acceptable in terms of how you present as a woman, because it's something that I was challenged with as a young girl. So much for tomboy, and I really embraced that. I was out rolling around the mud, playing football. I didn't really care about my appearance. I had probably a monobrow. My hair was a mess. I never used to wear bras. It wasn't until later on that I went to secondary school that it was like, oh, you need to pluck your eyebrows in. Why aren't you wearing a bra? And you're not pretty to men. And that was when I started changing. But actually, up until that point, I was the tomboy. And it was just so authentically me. And I really resonate with having to unpick that conditioning, being a young girl and being in the mosque with my dad and playing football, and the shock on all of the men that I was so good at football. It was like an unseen thing, a woman that can do kick-ups and can play football. It was just like a glitch in the matrix.
Yeah.
I always loved challenging that, actually. But I think a lot of women might resonate. What does it mean to be a woman and how do we unpick that? Because I'm not resonating with what society is telling me. And I love that you talked about the journey of self-acceptance through this. And you talked about seeing the wild rawness of some of these goddesses, or goddesses that express rage. So not the traditional beautiful, feminine, soft, which I love to.
Yeah.
But it's like, it's nice as a woman to kind of have a bigger space to express.
Yeah.
And I often feel, living with a health condition myself, that part of that, having Crohn's disease, part of that journey for me was a lot of trauma that I experienced and a lot of repressed anger, that I was angry at a lot of things in my life and I wasn't safe. I wasn't allowed to be angry. I wasn't allowed to be anxious. And I believe that the disease, this dis-ease that developed in my body for many reasons, perhaps genetics, many things I can't go into now, but a lot of that was my repressed anger and frustration. I know a lot of women that have now got autoimmune conditions, most women I know have gut health problems.
Mm.
And I think part of that it's not acceptable as a woman to be angry, frustrated, express rage.
So we literally swallow and attempt to digest within us what needs to be expressed. And then it comes out in other ways, right?
Yeah. So I think it's an interesting this journey of perhaps seeing goddesses that are actually expressing their fierceness and wildness, and how many of us as women, it would probably be very healing to know that that is also womanhood. It's not just soft, quiet kindness and politeness. It's actually, your rage can be sacred too. Question that came to me was, I would love to know if there are any goddesses that you're really excited to learn about, or any particular stories that really uplifted you or excited you, because you did mention kind of wanting to bring out the shadows and the more gnarly, wild, raw, fierce. Are there any goddesses that really bring that out that we can learn about?
Yeah, there are so many. So I guess one of the like ones that's more at the forefront of consciousness and is actually like in the mainstream as like a darker face of the feminine is probably Kali. She's from the varying traditions in India. But Kali is quite universal in many of the traditions of India. She's like recognized and celebrated. And her imagery is quite confronting, let's say. When you see her, she wears like a garland, a necklace of human heads, and a skirt that is made from arms, human arms, severed arms. And she's standing on the body of Shiva. And her tongue is, like, this is the most classic image of her. Her tongue is sticking out, sometimes dripping with blood. She's holding a severed head that's also, like, dripping blood from the neck, and holding a big, like, a massive knife or sword in her hand. And, you know, there's this thing of, like, oh, Carly's really scary. And, like,
quite a terrifying image, isn't it?
And so when we look at the etymology of her name, the Kal in Kali, it means time. And so we can understand from this that Kali is the rhythm of life, is that pulse of time passing, and her ferocity, her fierceness, is when we're trying to not be in the now. So, like, if you're trying to hold on to something in the past, time doesn't stop for anybody. It's going to keep going. So it feels really ruthless when you're trying to stay in a moment that's actually already gone. So Carly cuts away everything that doesn't serve this moment, that isn't right now. Also, like, you're unable to look at the future. So there's, like, a real, actually, like, a gentleness in, it's like honing you down to this, to right now. When we try and prevent that passage of time that is inevitable, then it's going to feel really uncomfortable. So this energy of Carly can feel uncomfortable if we're not surrendered to the present moment, and we're not surrendered to the constant change that is time. And another layer, like, within the traditions of India, often this image of the severed head, it's like representing the ego. And so Carly is, like, cutting the ego off us. It's like an ego death. So one story of Carly, one is a very famous story, is there's, like, a time in the world when there's a lot of, like, evil beings, demons, ego driven people, and a bit like now. And, like, the Devas and Devis, the gods and goddesses, are like, oh my god, you know, we need to do something about this. There's no peace anymore in the world. What do we do? And Shiva's like, ah, it's all right, guys, I got this. One version of the story says he, like, tears one of his dreadlocks from his head, and he, like, whips it, cracks it on the floor, and out of the dreadlock springs Carly. There's other versions of how she materializes, but I really like this one. So she, like, materializes out of the dreadlock, and they're like, all right, Carly, can you, like, get rid of everything that has ego? And she goes down and starts, like, taking the heads off all the demons and the ego-driven beings. And they're like, great, you know, she's doing it, like, everyone's being destroyed that's got all of this ego. But then she's done all the, like, supposedly, like, evil, in inverted commas, beings, and she continues. She just starts destroying everyone because she can't see that anyone that doesn't have ego. Everyone has a bit. So she's just continuing, and it is fucking carnage. Like, there is blood everywhere. There's heads everywhere. Like, and she just doesn't stop. It's the Devas and the Devis, they're just like, oh my god, she's going to destroy everyone. There'll be nothing left because everybody has this ego. She's just continuing. And then so they're like, oh my god, like, Shiva, you got to do something about your missus. Like, she's going to destroy all of us. Help! You know, like, so Shiva, like, goes down amidst the carnage, and she's sort of, like, blinded by her rampage, and he lies amongst the dead bodies. He lies on the floor, knowing that she's gonna pass him. And as she, like, almost, like, drunk in her, it's like become a bloodlust, this thing. She's, like, almost drunk in it. She stumbles through the body, she steps onto him, and when she steps onto him, she finally has found something without ego. And so that's that moment that's depicted with the tongue sticking out, like a bit like a dog, you know, that's like panting after running. It's like, finally, she's like satiated and finds peace because she's not confronted by all this ego. So that's like one version of the story. And it's really interesting. There's a really similar story in the ancient Kemetic culture, what we often call ancient Egypt. The story of Sekhmet, where she's like the lioness, the lion-headed goddess, or Neteru, as they're called in that tradition. She's also like sent down to like kill all the evil beings and people that are driven by ego and lust and all of these things. And she ends up on this rampage that's unstoppable because she just sees it everywhere. And they're like, fuck, what do we do? And in their version of the story, they end up mixing some kind of alcohol. Like, I like to think it was probably mead. They like mix it with red colour from the earth, like a red pigment. So it's like, it looks like blood. I think in some stories, like, it's actually like put in the Nile so that the river is running red. And so when she gets to it, she thinks it's blood. And in her bloodlust, she drinks it and she gets drunk and then she falls asleep. And that's how they satiate her in the story. But it's very similar, this kind of idea of the goddess on her rampage. Something in it of like, you know, well, we all have flaws.
Yeah.
Like, no one is perfect, so everyone is subject to the same retribution.
Yeah.
We all have things within us that are problematic.
Yeah.
You know, and we can all do better. We can all, coming back to that idea of bhakti, we can all learn to be more loving and more caring to the earth and to our fellow humans. And in the Indian traditions, there's a really big thing around demons in a lot of stories, like, how do we let these demons not take over us? So there's a really beautiful text called the Devi Mahatmyam, which tells the story of Durga. Kali makes an appearance in this one as well. Durga has been like sent to kill loads of demons that the rest of the gods can't kill. I'm really abbreviating things. But when you look at like the translation of the demons' names, they're things like self-deprecation. They're things like conceit. They're those negative thoughts that our minds have when you translate the names of the demons. They're actually showing us something about ourselves, like what's going on in our mind. What negative thoughts do we have that are, in essence, actually demonic energies that we need to slay? And this idea that the goddess is slaying the negative thoughts that we have so that we can be more at peace in our minds. There's something so beautiful about that for me.
I think it's powerful as well that a woman saves the world in all of these goddesses. That's not the only thing I hold on to, but it's a woman to come in. No, obviously she's a massively helped in that situation too, but I think it's really powerful for women to hear stories of the rage of the feminine, of the power of the feminine, because it makes us feel more powerful and it takes away from a lot of traditions that maybe perhaps without even meaning to be misogynistic, there is the idea for some it's like that the woman is really soft and must be protected. But within that means cover up, stay at home and don't lead any of the prayers. And for me, I'm like, whoa, that's like really misogynistic. For them, that's like, but the woman is soft, she needs to, you know, she needs to be protected, or she's on her bleed, she definitely can't come to the temple. And it's just all of these stories where the woman is kind of hidden away. And I love that you shared this story of Kali and Sekhmet and their fierce power to protect us from the demons. And I also love that you talked about the demons, that we can see it as things like self-deprecation, or for me, something I've been really navigating is comparison. Of, they're really shining, you can't shine. they're better than you. Don't even bother.
Yeah.
A lot around creativity, it really plagues me. It's like, well, they're a better musician, so just don't even bother.
Yeah.
There's no space for you here. Why are you trying? And it's self-deprecating.
Yeah.
So the idea of calling on Carly or these goddess energies to kind of defeat these quite demonic thought processes that are holding us back, taking us away from self-love, stopping us from connecting. Because when I'm feeling that someone is better than me, then I'm not connected to God. I'm in my own mind of unworthiness. So I think it's really powerful that you've brought it down to almost like the human level of this is something that plays out and that we can invoke these energies to support us.
And I think that's a really important thing about these stories, and that like this is part of the tradition. Like, yes, in my book, I'm talking to people and I'm hearing personal stories. But like so many of these traditions, lessons are passed down through oral stories about these forms of the sacred. They've got morals in them. They've got like actually real practical applications for life. It's like how we learn to be in the world is through the, like these stories are really important.
Yeah.
The more you dive into the stories and understand the nuances of them as well.
I would love to see more of these stories in the mainstream rather than the story of the one male superhero that can save the world and that it takes this one man that's going to save the world, or old Disney stories and stuff that it's like the woman is not happy and then she finds the prince and now she's happy and fulfilled and that's it. That's the only part of her journey is to find the man. And it's kind of like, of course, beautiful, I celebrate love, but it's a bit like, oh, okay, well, not that inspired. So is that my one purpose of this life? And so I'd love to hear these stories come through more. And I think that's what's so powerful about you writing the book is I'm just imagining younger girls and their mums or something, dads, like reading these stories and then feeling all of this inspiration. So,
because it's not very PG, some of my writing.
Of theirs. Leave that bit out.
And there's lots of sexy stuff also.
Maybe like the teenage girl then is more. But you also said something really beautiful when I interviewed you last.
So oh, yeah.
You said these forms of the sacred feminine are like potent facets of divinity that both manifest within us and within creation.
Mm.
And we can connect with and evoke certain energies within us, but also to give thanks for certain gifts we receive within this life, representative of certain aspects of creation of life. That's a really beautiful way to sum things up.
Yeah, for me that's definitely really important in my relationship with how I connect with these forms of the sacred feminine, and not just the sacred feminine, sacred being in general, is this like invoking and cultivating particular themes and moods within myself that they represent, but also like giving thanks to these beings for how that's manifested in my life already.
Really love to learn more about the Yoni Shakti retreats you facilitate alongside Uma. You've known Uma and worked with her for over 15 years and have traveled the world sharing about cyclical awareness, the wisdom of our body's cycles, yoga therapy practices to support menstrual well-being, and pussy power in general. So could you tell us about these Yoni Shakti retreats and how us female bodied folk can benefit from this work?
One of the core elements of our of the teaching is about cyclical wisdom and how we can understand femininity and like how that presents as something that is cyclical and not constant. We move through seasons, like we can witness how the earth moves through seasons. We are in winter and in that dark place of resting, and then we move into the springtime where everything begins to wake up and emerge, and then we move into that abundant outward expression of the summer, and then into that kind of editing and shedding time that is the autumn before diving into the winter again. And it's this constant cycle. It's not the same every cycle, but it constantly is unfolding. And those of us who are in who have, you know, female bodies with wombs and have this experience of menstruation, we have a really powerful teacher of this cyclical wisdom that is directly offered from our own body. And so there is this learning that if we're open to actually listening, which a lot of us don't, and are like numbing out our bleeds with taking contraceptives and all kinds of things, and there are many reasons that we might do that, and that can be really necessary also. But when we allow our body to do its own thing and we have this potential to like listen to it, we can also like map these seasons within ourselves, with the bleed being that like wintry inward place. Coming out of the bleed, it's the springtime energy. Ovulation is that really like big yes moment out in the world thing. And then the autumn is the editing. Often it's like the premenstrual is often like the time when people criticize people who are experiencing a menstrual cycle because they think that they're like, it's like they're angry, or and it manifests in different ways. Like for some it can be like an outward expression of like anger, whereas others it can be more inward directed and become more like self-deprecating, and like the inner critic becomes really strong rather than the outer critic. But that's like a manifestation of like editing and perhaps dealing with all the stuff that you haven't dealt with the rest of the cycle. It's like you just can't tolerate it anymore at that point, and so it comes across as quite harsh. Also, as part of this work, Uma wrote this big red book that's called Yoni Shakti, and this basically means like source power. Yoni is an interesting Sanskrit word. Like often it gets translated as womb or vagina, but actually like probably the closest word in the English language in like a physical resonance would actually be like cunt, which has like all of the female sexual anatomy at once together. Yoni also can be translated as source. It's like the place where creation begins. And a little footnote on that, it's like not necessarily like the creation in the form of like babies and things, but like the creative energy lives there, and all that is manifest from like seeded from creation can be thought as having roots in the yoni. And then it also can mean home, like to come home to, like this is like a place of home. And so when we say yoni shakti, shakti is like power. It's the feminine force of power. It's creative power. It's the creative energy. So yoni shakti, it's the creative energy that lives in the source of our being. And it's not necessarily related to the physical place of the uterus. Like whether or not there is a physical womb present, it's this like place in the body where there is a meeting between earth and water. It's like muddy and juicy. It's where things grow. In the yogic anatomy, it's like the crossover point between Muladhara chakra, the root chakra or the earth chakra, and Svadhisthana chakra, which is the like water chakra. So it's like where they meet, and it's all muddy and and gooey and like juicy. Yeah, it's like I said, it's where stuff grows, where our creative energy can be birthed from. So a lot of the work that we do is like about connecting with this energy and honoring the rhythms of this energy, which is in constant cycle. Part of the creative process is also non-doing, is also rest. Part of it is editing. Part of it is output. There are all the different phases of the creative process, and they all are within us. And like, how do we listen to that? How do we pay attention to our intuition? as we journey through the cycles.
I'm just already like signing myself up of like, I want to come on this retreat. And I have so much to learn. It feels like going back to witch's school. All the sex education that we never got.
Oh, yes.
It was so awful that all I remember was a condom on a banana. I don't remember anything that was really useful. I don't remember ever talking about cyclical wisdom or bleed. Anything that would have really helped me to connect to my body, that was missed. And it was just very basic surface level stuff. So this feels like really, really powerful work, and so many people would really need to and benefit from learning about cyclical wisdom. I have felt disconnected from my body from a very long time, and I felt a sense of shame around my bleed, because in growing up in a Muslim culture, it was kind of like that was seen as a, oh, keep hush hush, you can't do certain spiritual practice around the bleed. So I felt it was a bit of an uncomfortable thing. I've also found the pre-bleed part very challenging, very heightened, and almost wanted to skip that and felt so disconnected from my body. And recently I was very late on my bleed, and I then synced up with the full moon. It was a very challenging time. A lot of repressed anger and sadness that didn't have a place to move, as well as being really busy. And I felt so disconnected from my body without my bleed. And when my bleed did come, the gratitude and love that I felt for being in this cycle. And I found this sort of magic even staring at my blood, because I felt so happy to be connected to my body again. I was just staring at my blood on my pad, with just gratitude and love, and then also awe at the mystery of the fact that I was bleeding. And I swear, again, I'm going to sound a bit nutty, I was seeing shapes and images in my blood where part of it looked like a bird, part of it actually looked like a female goddess that was really curvaceous. So I was kind of like tripping out, actually really looking at my blood in a way that I never had, because it's dirty and it's shameful, and speak about your blood. And even the fact that it's called period feels really odd. And I laugh because my sister's
Do you know what the root of that is?
What? Oh, he's gonna make me angry.
It's short for periodic illness.
What?
Okay. So I choose not to use that word. I like to call it what it is.
Bleeds.
Bleeds, menstrual cycle. And then when we're actually in the bleed time, I like to use the word bleed, because it calls the spade, and actually brings like into the consciousness what is happening to us, rather than all these euphemisms of like aunt flow coming to down or whatever.
Yeah.
Fuck. You know, like, or I mean, even like moon time, which is lovely, but it's still like a euphemism. Yeah. It's like, actually, I'm bleeding right now.
Well, my sisters get so triggered when I say bleed. It really makes me laugh, and I almost say it more trigger them. But they're like, oh, that's disgusting. And I tried to explain, I was like, but I'm bleeding. What is so disgusting? And that made me really sad that my sisters, as two women, felt so repulsed by the word bleed, even though we are bleeding.
And there's so much shame and stigma around the bleed. And I think what is really important in the core of all of this is a lot of this kind of shame and stigma around the bleed is actually like a fear of our power. Because to be like present with the gifts of what this full cycle offers us is to be fully in tune with our power. When we dismiss any part of the cycle, we diminish our power, because when we think about the land, you can't have the flower without the quiet moment where there isn't anything on the tree. You can't have the fruit without the flower having happened. The fruit then contains the seeds that birth a new cycle. It's this constant thing where everything is feeding each other. Like often when we talk to women about how their cycle manifests, like one of the things that we've found is this kind of like resonance across points of the cycle. If you overdo it in the summer and like during ovulation, you're like super, 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 super out, 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 out. The stereotype is that is a really easy time to be in the outward energy. It's the time that we're most celebrated for. When we act like we're there the whole time,
often you might have issues when you actually come to bleed because you haven't reserved any energy to do that work. Or, for instance, if you rush out of your bleed straight into summer, we often see more struggles in the autumn if you've rushed out of your bleed. So, like, you see it, like, opposite the cycle, how it, like, impacts. It's really fascinating.
It is, and it's kind of like trying to learn to have respect for our bodies and our womb, that we can't be on the whole time. It's fearsome.
Yeah.
I don't need any rest and I don't need nobody. And then I burn out. I like that you mentioned in your book that the darker phases of the cycle were not celebrated. They did not fit into the linear expectation of the patriarchal society that these women were part of. This unfortunately means that the autumn energies of saying no, truth speaking, and fierce clarity, as well as the winter energies of rest, inner awareness, and visionary experience, are often judged as being without value. They tend to not be so respected within this culture of productivity.
Yeah.
And I really resonate with that, actually, as someone that's been a chronic people pleaser and really struggled to put in boundaries, say no, and then having this recent experience of this extended pre-period phase and not coming on my bleed and feeling so disconnected from my body. These parts of the cycle are also of value. It's not just, woohoo, it's summer, let's go and party. It's like, these can be really powerful times if we connect with that. But I think, like you were saying, in this society where we must be busy and switched on the whole time, the wisdom of these parts of the cycle are lost.
Yeah.
And we do become disconnected.
And yet, without them, we are less productive. Without the rest phase, we have less to give for that productive point. It's like we think there's this sort of weird idea that keep going, keep doing, but you're actually more productive if you take the time to rest. So we have to cycle.
We're cyclical beings.
Yeah.
So grateful for you, Shivani. Magical, remarkable.
So grateful for you.
Listen back to this and learn so much. I know so many people will. I think it's really beautiful. I love hearing your stories. I love the magic of you writing this book. I cannot wait for it to be published.
Yeah.
I'm so curious about these retreats. Thank you, magical witch, yogini, priestess, woman. So grateful.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. I hope you feel as inspired by Shivani as I do. To learn more about her work and her offerings and her music, please follow the links in the description. And now, to finish this episode, here is a full play of Shivani's beautiful song, Guide Me Home.
Fire burning in my soul, hey great spirit, guide me home. Fire burning in my soul, hey great spirit, guide me home. Hey great spirit, guide me home. Hey great spirit, guide me home. I am the sky, I am the river flowing by. I am the earth, I am the sky, I am the river flowing by. Fire burning in my soul, hey great spirit, guide me home. Fire burning in my soul, hey great spirit, guide me home. Oh, hey great spirit, guide me home. Hey great spirit, guide me home. I am the earth, I am the sky, I am the river. spirit guide me home. Fire burning in my soul. Hey, great spirit, guide me home. Hey, great spirit, guide me home. Hey, great spirit, guide me home. What can I do? spirit.